From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, the Million Man March. Organizers are hoping that 1 million African-American men will gather in Washington, D.C. on Monday for a day of atonement, recommitment to family and community, and to send a message to America about racism in our country. We'll hear from two men who are organizing the Philadelphia contingent, Terry Johnson and Mark Harrell. We'll ask Jeffrey Canada how the young people he works with in Harlem are responding to the call. And we'll hear from Glenn Lowry, who writes about racial inequality and policy. He has reservations about the march. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Korva Coleman. The Republicans' plan to revamp Medicare is going to the floor of the House virtually unchanged. Democrats have been unable to alter it, and they've been strongly criticizing it. UPI's Shirley Smith prepared this report.
Democrats say the proposed Medicare and Medicaid reform plans will be a disaster for the United States. Florida Congressman Sam Gibbons says the people who need help the most in this country will be the ones most hurt.
They're going to do more to force people into poverty by the Medicare cuts and the Medicaid cuts that they have made in this last 2 days than any single thing that has ever happened in America in my lifetime.
Gibbons says that the Republicans tried to push the legislation through with no hearings, but that he thinks the word is now getting out and that average citizens are getting upset. Shirley Smith, Capitol Hill.
The White House says President Clinton will veto Republican spending cuts and force Congress to stay in Washington until a new spending package is crafted. House Speaker Newt Gingrich and Senate Leader Bob Dole say they will pressure the president to sign their legislation. They say they'll send Mr. Clinton all 12 remaining spending bills in mid-November, just as the government starts to run out of money. They intend to forward their budget balancing package at the same time and include crucial legislation to let the government keep borrowing money. Their strategy is designed to make the president accept Republican budget priorities or let the government go broke. The U.S. brokered ceasefire is taking hold in most of Bosnia, but there are reports from northwest Bosnia the Serbs are rushing to expel thousands of non-Serbs from the region. Bosnia's Foreign Minister Mohamed Shakarbey, speaking in Brussels, said the truce could be endangered if the expulsions continue.
If this peace process is to succeed, then these types of crimes must stop and, in fact, must be reversed. We're not going to sit here and fool ourselves by going along with a fake peace process. One of the first tests of the potential success of this peace process is whether or not, in fact, the crimes of ethnic cleansing will be stopped.
The truce is supposed to lead to negotiations in the United States at the end of the month and later a peace conference in Paris. Wholesale prices rose 0.3% in September, the steepest monthly increase in 8 months. Food prices were up, and so were car prices. Declining energy prices offset much of the advance. Analyst Robert Diedrich says the increase was expected.
We're having trouble with supplies this year in one area or another, and we are getting higher food prices as a result. This has not been a good year for crops because of the weather, and that is going to have some impact almost certainly on food prices as time goes on.
Excluding volatile food and energy prices, the core rate of inflation rose 0.2%. On Wall Street, the Dow is up almost 15 points. This is NPR. An official with the Treasury Department has told a House subcommittee that the new smart money cards carry the risk of fraud. In yesterday's testimony, the head of the department's crime enforcement network told committee members the cards could eventually allow consumers to conceal large amounts of money. NPR's Greg Peppers reports.
At issue is the developing technology that allows cash to be stored on wallet-sized plastic cards equipped with a computer chip. The chip is capable of holding far more information than the magnetic strips now on credit and debit cards. Wells Fargo Bank is testing one version of the stored value card in San Francisco, and about 90 bank employees and 9 merchants are taking part in the experiment. The new cards could store small amounts of money as a substitute for pocket change. The Treasury Department is concerned that the cards could someday be used for big transactions or to store large amounts of money. Stanley Morris is head of the department's Financial Crimes Enforcement Network. He yesterday testified before the House Banking Subcommittee. Morris told committee members that if the cards can be loaded with value, current systems for tracking funds could lose their effectiveness. Federal Reserve Chairman Alan Blinder warned lawmakers that the government could lose revenue if electronic cash replaces a major portion of the $400 billion in U.S. currency in circulation worldwide. I'm Greg Peppers in Washington.
The Carnegie Foundation says that the country is ignoring dangers faced by about half of American adolescents. A foundation panel's completed a 10-year study and concluded nearly half the Americans between the ages of 10 and 14 have a moderate or high risk of seriously damaging their life chances. The dangers range from drug and alcohol abuse to teen pregnancy, education, and poverty. The panel says a major problem is more parents are in the workforce and more kids have more independence at a young age when they still need protection and guidance. Researchers recommend smaller schools for better relationships between teachers and students and flex time for parents at work. This is NPR.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. African American men from around the country are traveling to Washington, D.C. for Monday's Million Man March. Described by its organizers as a day of atonement and recommitment to family and community, the demonstration is also intended to raise the nation's consciousness about the economic and social predicament of black men. Ben Chavis, one of the organizers, says this will be the broadest display of black unity in American history. But some African American leaders are not endorsing this march, in part because of its controversial leader, Louis Farrakhan. We'll be hearing several points of view on the Million Man March. My first guest, Terry Johnson, is the head of communications with the march's Philadelphia Organizing Committee. He publishes an African American paper in Philadelphia called The Real News, is a former senior editor at The Village Voice, and a former general editor at Newsweek. I asked him if he had personal reasons for helping to organize the march.
I've always been involved in the movement, in the black movement. I think perhaps since the age of 12, I've been involved. And my involvement, I've always tried to make it more than just a sort of peripheral or occasional concern. I mean, I try to spend the time reading and studying social and economic movements, so on and so forth, to have a real, intellectual understanding as well as a practical understanding through involvement, of the movement. So participating in the march is really a very natural thing for me to do.
What is the march about?
The march is about recommitment to the struggle for justice on an individual level and on a collective level within the African-American community. And in some ways, when you say atonement and recommitment, it has a very general meaning, but there are also some very specific things about that, too, because one can only recommit themselves, not just, to their individual pursuits, but also to the social pursuits. We are, after all, social beings. And so it's a recommitment to the struggle for social justice for African Americans, and I would argue for every American.
The Million Man March is being described as a day of atonement. Who is atoning and for what?
One of the things that I like to be very clear about, because, even in the African-American community, the sense that some people have is that black men will be going down to Washington, sort of hanging our heads and say, guilty as charged by European Americans. We have been derelict fathers. We've been criminals. We've been drug dealers. But that's not what it's about. And that's not what we are atoning for. What we're doing is atoning for our, I guess, lack of commitment in an intense kind of way to the struggle for social and economic justice. That's what we're most concerned about and most focused on.
Now, you're walking to Washington.
Right. Mm-hmm.
Why
mm-hmm.
are you walking?
Well, I'm walking with a group of people. I'm joining them, actually. They've been on the road for 2 days now. There are an interesting group of people that are walking. The leader of the group is a guy named Jerome Dorn, a Vietnam veteran. And Jerome says he suffers from post-traumatic stress syndrome. And when we initially started talking about the idea of the march, Jerome said he wanted to go for all those African-American men, all those brothers that didn't make it back from Vietnam. He also wanted to march for all those brothers who are incarcerated or locked down in some form in America's prisons and jails. He wanted to march on their behalf. But also along with Jerome are 20 participants in a program called Germantown Turn It Over, drug addicts, alcoholics who are making that march. It's a tremendous commitment. And each one of those people have their own reasons for wanting to march. But for me, the symbol of the march is that We're very serious about change in America. We're serious about it. We're willing to take a bus to get down to Washington to press our point, but we're also willing to use other means to get to Washington to press our point. And I think the people who are walking are the symbols of that determination to bring about serious and fundamental change in America.
When did you start walking?
I will leave either tonight or tomorrow morning, taking provisions, water, as well as socks and whatnot to the people who are on the road. And then we'll, you know, walk from wherever I catch up with them into D.C.
What's your route?
We're taking the route of the Underground Railroad, which is down Route 1. And there are several significant stops laid out by Charlie Blackson, the noted historian, places where runaway slaves rested and where anti-slavery rallies and meetings and so forth were held. And we think that that's a very important symbol.
One of the controversies surrounding the Million Man March is that it's a man march. There's mm-hmm. women have been asked to not come, mm-hmm. although two women will be speaking, Rosa Parks and Maya Angelou. What's your understanding of the reasons for asking women to not participate in the march?
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, I think that there are two sources of that kind of thinking. One, I think there are special conditions that African American men face, and not to say they're any worse more urgent than the issues facing African American women. But there is a disproportionate number of African-American men who are, you know, in prisons and jails, dying of various diseases and whatnot at, you know, premature ages. Unemployment is extremely high, drug and alcohol addiction. So I think there are some particular problems that African-American men face. And also, I think racism has done a particularly dastardly job in eroding the humanity of African-American men. So a political move like this, I think, is a reaffirmation of our humanity as black people, but also, you know, as males. And I don't see it as necessarily a contradiction in any way or antagonistic to the notion of African-American women, feminism, or even, you know, womanist thinking. I think that, you know, there can be times when it's appropriate for men to sit together, just as there are times when it's appropriate for women to sit together because of particular concerns about, women.
The march, in a way, is important in part because of its symbolic value.
Mm-hmm.
You know, hopefully a million men, this is what you're hoping for, mm-hmm. gathering in Washington for a day of atonement. I mean, this is about symbolism and about personal transformation mm-hmm. in a lot of ways. Given the symbolic value of the march, I wonder how you feel about one of the main organizers of the march, Louis Farrakhan, and his symbolic value, because for a lot of people in America, what he symbolizes is divisiveness.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of women have been uncomfortable with his views about women. Gay people are uncomfortable with his views about gays. Jewish people are uncomfortable with what he said about Jews. A lot of white people are uncomfortable with what he said about whites in general. So I'd like you to speak to the symbolic value of mm-hmm. Farrakhan heading mm-hmm. the march.
You know, I think it was maybe in 1985, I went to an appearance by Farrakhan at Reverend Gray's church, White Hope Baptist Church. It was a rainy day. It had been raining all day. Sky was gray. And there was a line of people, you know, out of the church and, you know, down the block, lined up to hear Louis Farrakhan speak. They filled the church sanctuary, the basement, and a recreation hall. And that many people there to hear Louis Farrakhan. And these weren't, you know, big city officials there and whatnot. These were just simply grassroots people in the black community to hear Louis Farrakhan's message. And I argue that the reason they were there is because what the Nation of Islam represents in its general sense is a trend in the, you know, intellectual development or the thinking of the black community that has very deep roots. It could be traced to Garveyism, and that's where the roots of the Nation of Islam go, and a lot of black people are drawn by that message of self-reliance and, you know, up you miney race and Africa for the Africans. Farrakhan represents that on the one hand. But also, too, and I think, you know, the other point that you're making is some of the comments that Farrakhan have made, you know, particularly comments that have been labeled, you know, anti-Jewish or anti-Semitic comments. I think I sort of view that as I think that there's a need for dialogue in America about racial questions. And as long as we suppress that dialogue, there are going to be occasions whenever a window sort of open or a door is open, there are going to be these shots of cold air that blast in. And you know, they hit people in the face and slap them around. And people don't understand how to interpret those things. So what I'm suggesting is that when Farrakhan's comments are made that sort of shake up people, that really is an opportunity for us to begin to engage in a dialogue about race relations in America. Because Farrakhan's comments are not just sort of isolated comments that simply are, you know, you find among, you know, one or two African Americans, but you find them among many African Americans who hold the sort of same views about Jews and about European Americans in general. And those are the kind of questions that we need to start talking about in America, rather than saying, well, what we should do is condemn each person that sort of, you know, raises their head and there's only one of them. You know, like the argument perhaps that there's only one Mark Furman. Now, while some people may hold that belief that Mark Furman is a rare creature, we don't, you know, a lot of African Americans don't hold that view. We think that the police department in and of itself is Mark Furman, that's how they operate with us. And we need to have a dialogue about how do we change the police department so that it's a positive thing.
Terry Johnson, you're head of the communications committee of the Philadelphia chapter of the Million Man March. And you've written up a list of goals, can we call it, mm-hmm. for the march, a paper that you call What We Seek.
Right.
And this is not like a national agenda, but it's something you've written up that's what?
It's a document for the Philadelphia Local Organizing Committee, and it sort of lays out some of the things that we want to achieve, not just with this march, but with this movement in general. And, you know, it starts, of course, with this whole notion of recommitment to the struggle for justice, which is a recommitment to self. And it also demands reparations in America. And I think that a very compelling case can be made for that, you know, that African Americans are owed or need to be made whole because of the contributions that their ancestors made to providing the basis for wealth in America and the continuing discrimination that we face in the workplace now. But also we think that reparations should be a first step toward economic justice for all Americans. 1% of the population controls between 40% and 60% of the wealth. That's not good for African Americans, but that's not good for working Americans in general. And that's certainly not good for any notions of democracy in America. We want to change that.
I'm going to ask you one O.J. Simpson question, because I think, you know, when the verdict came down, so much of the reaction seemed to divide along racial mm-hmm. lines. Mm-hmm. And I think everybody's been trying, scratching their heads and thinking, what are we to make of this? What does this tell us about race mm-hmm. in America? And, you know, I was reading something that you wrote called The Vision, mm-hmm. which is a statement about, you know, the vision for the march. Mm-hmm. And you wrote, we believe we must atone for the abuse and misuse of our women and girls.
Mm-hmm.
And I was reading that and thinking, wondering what went through your mind when you saw a lot of African Americans cheering O.J. Simpson's not guilty verdict, knowing that, you know, whether he's innocent or guilty of murder, he did abuse his wife. I mean, that's just uncontested.
Mm-hmm.
And mm-hmm. I think it's been something that's been so hard for a lot of people to reconcile, the applause.
Mm-hmm.
for someone who undeniably beat his wife.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, I can compare it to something. You know, when the president walks in the room, you know, they play Hail to the Chief, you know. And I could, you know, look at George Bush or, you know, even Bill Clinton and see some of the things that they've done and this country has done to people. And nevertheless, people applaud. They snap to attention and say, well, you know, what's more important? You know, the fact that maybe we killed, you know, some Iraqis when they were ready to surrender and on the run, or, you know, the fact that we allow discrimination and sexism to remain rampant in the country, and we still applaud and cheer and snap to attention, you know, because of these other concerns. And I think that for Black people, what we were thinking is, listen, you know, there's also this issue of justice here in America, whether we can get justice in the courts. And when I hear people talk about OJ and they say, well, you know, Jesus Christ, you know, Black people cheering a man beat his wife, you know, and I say, damn, you know, I can tell you some stories about some things that I see going on in my community as a result of racism and injustice, and no one says a word, you know, and particularly white America stands by silent and shaking its head too often, saying, oh, boy, those crazy niggas, you know, and I see the terrible things that are coming as a result of the setup that has benefited some European Americans in this country. and to the detriment of my people. You know, one of the things that also kind of compels me to be involved in this march, not long ago, I lost a nephew, shot and killed. He may have been, you know, selling drugs and whatnot. But I know that from the moment that he was born, he never really had a chance in the first place. Right now in America, you could walk into a room full of newborn babies, 12 babies, and without knowing much about the background of these babies, perhaps maybe the income, you can say some things about what's going to happen to those kids in the future. If they're 12 males, one's going to be murdered, the other's going to be the murderer. 50% of them are going to be going to drop out of school. And up until a certain age, maybe 60 to 70% of them will be unemployed. And as long as I know that happens, you know, what a horrible thing to have to live with, knowing that your children will not have a chance to breathe and ever really live. You know, now I hear European Americans say, well, Jesus Christ, you know, the OJ, and OJ beat his wife, and aren't you guys pissed off, you know, about that? And, you know, we would be pissed off. But, you know, it's like, Jesus, you know, come to my community, come to my house, live in my world for a while.
Terry Johnson is the head of communications for the Philadelphia Local Organizing Committee of the Million Man March. We'll hear from another local organizer after a break. This is Fresh Air. Mark Harrell is with the Mobilization Committee of the Million Man March's Philadelphia Contingent. He directs a youth gang and drug prevention program called Project Flow, which stands for Future Leaders of the World. I asked him what he imagines when he thinks about Monday.
Visually, I smile when I think about it. I lived in Washington, D.C. for quite a number of years. And as I close my eyes and I see the mall area, I see a convergence of black men coming to the Capitol steps, coming to the mall area from all directions to atone. I really believe that the message of this day being a holy day and a day of atonement is a message that's really hitting home, and a lot of the brothers that's going to take part in this historical event.
The Million Man March is in part a day of atonement. Atoning for what?
Well, what I believe is that before we can go out and ask anyone else to do anything for us, we first need to look within ourselves and look at the wrongs that we as black men have done in our communities. 68% of the households in the United States of America headed by single females. Something happened there while that man is not in that household. We need to atone for the way women are viewed through records and television and movies. I mean, this whole misogyny that surrounds how women are even talked about is something that we must stop. You know, that we look at the number of children who are walking the streets fatherless. We look at the number of black men who are in prison for reasons that they need to be there for. I mean, we need to, as a brotherhood, atone for our sins so that we can come out and be righteous in asking other brothers to come back to their communities and come back to their families.
Now, you're a part of the Mobilization Committee for the
Right.
March in Philadelphia.
Right.
How have you been trying to reach men and convince them to come to Washington?
We have men and women from all different walks of life who have been going door to door, leafleting the community with information, selling the T-shirts and hats and the buttons that help pay for the march. We've been manning telephone hotlines. We've been actually going out to community organizations, businesses, individuals' homes, and helping them to understand the purpose of this march. We've been spreading our message across the country.
I imagine a lot of the men who you want to reach are men who aren't necessarily part of organizations, right? So how are you trying to reach men who, if this is a march that's about atonement in part, how are you trying to reach men who aren't close to their families or who aren't employed or who are involved in illegal activities. People you can't reach through some of the traditional networks.
You have to remember that the people who are part of this mobilization effort are people who live in the communities or are part of the communities with these people. We're all, some of them are family members, brothers and sisters of ours. I mean, it's not hard to reach out or to go outside your door or stay in your house and say to someone next to you, this is what we're trying to do. These are our people. These are not people that have been cast away. I mean, these are people that walk the same streets that we walk. So it's not hard to turn to a brother, turn to a sister and say, listen, this is what October 16th, 1995 is about. And this is what the days after the 16th are about. And this is how we need you to be a part of this.
Tell me what you've been telling men about why you think they should come.
Well, one of the things I personally ask them to do is do a personal inventory, take a personal inventory of themselves and look at their lives and try to understand how he himself could better by being a part of this. And once brothers start looking into themselves and they say, well, yeah, you know, maybe I got a child here that, I've been kind of lax on the child support, or, yeah, maybe there's a situation in my community where I know something's happening, and if I just step up, I can alleviate some of that negativity. And I tell them that we're not going to Washington to ask permission. We're going to Washington to first to look in the mirror. And we're going to see black men from all over this country. And we're basically going to be looking in the mirror and saying to ourselves, it's time. And that's why we say the time is now. And you are expected.
Mark Harrell is an organizer of the Philadelphia contingent of the Million Man March. He directs a youth gang and drug prevention program called Project Flow. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations, and by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, we continue our discussion of Monday's Million Man March in Washington. We'll hear from Jeffrey Canada, who works with young people in Harlem and has written about young people and violence in America. And Glenn Lowry, the author of a new book of essays on race and responsibility in America.
Thank you.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. On the first part of our show, we heard from two organizers of the Million Man March's Philadelphia contingent. They're hoping that 1 million African-American men will gather in Washington, D.C. for a day of atonement and recommitment to family and community, and to send a message about the economic and social predicament of African-American men. Glenn Lowry has reservations about the march. Lowry's essays on race and responsibility in America are collected in the book One by One, From the Inside Out. He's a professor of economics at Boston University. I asked him his general impressions of the march.
Well, I think the march is a significant event. A million or even a quarter of a million black men coming together cannot be, dismissed, looked upon lightly. I think the march is two things. It's a communal event and it's a political event. As a communal event, it's black men looking into the depths of our souls, atoning, praying, trying to reconstruct and resurrect and all of that. I think that's very powerful, and that accounts for why it is that the idea of this march has, struck the imaginations of so many people. However, as a political event, I think that it's problematic for me, deeply problematic, particularly against the backdrop of the troubled race relations and the increasing conservatism of the American polity. I want to think that the only way we can really make progress in this country is blacks and whites working together on our problems. And I do have grave misgivings about Minister Farrakhan as a figure to be likened with Martin Luther King, someone who represents blacks in a leadership position to the rest of the nation.
What is the symbolic value to you of making Monday a day of atonement for African-American men?
Well, there is something to be atoned for. I think that there is no escaping the conclusion that we have failed. To say we African-American men have failed in our responsibilities before God and must now bend our knees and ask his forgiveness, this is tremendously powerful because it is true and because it taps a certain spiritual longing, which I believe is in every human heart and is certainly nevertheless still powerful in the black American men's, consciousness. There's no doubt that there's something there. I think it's very important.
Now, you mentioned that you were troubled by the idea of Minister Farrakhan having the same kind of leadership position in this march as Martin Luther King did in earlier marches. You're troubled by the equation of the two men. Let me get you to elaborate on that.
Well, 1963, Martin Luther King has already made himself a world-famous figure by leading a substantially successful struggle of blacks in the south of the United States, blacks along with whites, I might add, to counter and overturn Jim Crow segregation. This is a great moment in American history, culminating in that 1963 gathering on the Mall. This is up there with Lincoln, it seems to me, in terms of a reinterpretation of the American political dispensation so as to include the descendants of slaves. Now here we are, not even 35 years later, and we gather again on the Mall, but now we gather in a race-exclusive and sex-exclusive way, and we gather, at least in part, behind a man who hated what Martin Luther King stood for, behind a man who descends intellectually and spiritually from a theology of racial separatism and racial hatred, however much that hatred may have itself been a reaction to white hatred of blacks, it is nevertheless racial hatred. We gather in a political context that's inconsistent with the ideas of integration in a kind of universal, common public citizenship. It seems to me that's too high a price to get our cultural trains to run on time.
Well, I think this is a kind of complicated algebra for a lot of people, weighing the equation between a march whose symbolic value is very appealing and a leader who represents divisiveness for a lot of people. What is that algebra for you? What's the equation? How much does it matter to you that Farrakhan is one of the leaders of a march that has some very powerful, potent value, symbolic value for you?
It matters a great deal, and I would not march. Mm-hmm. I won't go to this march behind Louis Farrakhan. As it happens, I will be on the Mall to observe because I'm writing something about it, but I won't be, as it were, marching.
Mm-hmm.
And the reason for that is that we can't separate. When we go to Washington, when we gather in public on the Mall before the nation, the symbolic and spiritual dimension from the political message, those things are not separable. I think that Abe Rosenthal was right in that column he wrote in the New York Times. Even though he is himself often shrill on these issues, I believe he got it exactly right there. When you have a message like this, there is no separating the important spiritual principles and the ideals of self-help and even the accomplishments, which I think are there, the positive accomplishments of the Nation of Islam, from the fact that it embodies and reflects a doctrine that is inconsistent with liberal democracy in our country.
My guest is Glenn Lowry, author of the book One by One from the Inside Out, Essays and Reviews on Race and Responsibility in America. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. We're talking about the Million Man March. My guest is writer and professor Glenn Lowry. What's your reaction to this being a male-only march?
Again, I think when it's a public march of such political importance, it's quite inappropriate that it be male-only. If we were gathering in the various black communities, in the church basements or the mosque back rooms, men gathering to talk with men about how we had to face our responsibilities, atone for our sins, and get our communities right, I would see no more problem with that than I see with, women gathering at Wellesley College because that's an environment in which they can pursue their educations more effectively, they think. But when we gather on the Mall, hundreds of thousands strong, at least in part petitioning in our government and making declarations before the entire nation, neither race nor gender exclusivity in that context is appropriate, in my view.
What's your understanding of the reason why women are asked to not attend this march?
Well, I think it derives in part from the philosophy that animates the Nation of Islam movement, in which women have, an important and valued, but I think it has to be said, secondary place, at least insofar as leadership is concerned. I think it also has to do with the fact that the issue of responsibility cuts more sharply and deeply for men. After all, there's no escaping the fact that when these children come into the world, they are cared for by their mothers. It's their fathers who are not there. And there is an indictment implicit in the social situation of black Americans today, which I think is unavoidably an indictment of men. So there is both the kind of hierarchical philosophy of the march organizers along gender lines, but also the fact that there is this blatant, glaring failure of men to have done what we ought to have done. Both of which I think support this this male focus of the march.
And let me get your reaction to the march happening in Washington, D.C. What's the symbolic value of Washington, D.C. as the place for you?
Well, you know, if this march was a march about reconstruction of the black community, it should be in Anacostia to the extent that it's in Washington, D.C. You know, it should be on the east side of Detroit. It should be in Philadelphia, west side of Chicago, south central Los Angeles, Oakland, California, etc. It would be entirely possible to coordinate marches in all of those places in which black men confronted our responsibility to our respective communities. That the marches in Washington unequivocally marks it as a political event of national proportions in which a message is attempting to be sent to the nation, and in particular to a Republican Congress and to a president whom many African Americans feel is not sufficiently attentive to our interest. It is also on the site of the 1963 march. As such, if only one quarter of the numbers that Minister Farrakhan has called for show up, it will eclipse in its magnitude the march of 1963 and will unavoidably, inevitably, establish Minister Farrakhan as the premier figure within Black America. The fact that it takes place on the site of King's March is not incidental in that respect.
Do you think that African American men today are in a unique predicament?
Yes, I do. I don't buy conspiracy theories. I don't like this easy kind of victimology. Black men have suffered, et cetera, et cetera. But I would think that what with the violence of street gangs, the drug addiction and all the rest, the unemployment, the sense of hopelessness and uselessness, the alienation from family as well as from community and nation that characterizes the condition of Black men, there's no escaping the fact that there's something very special, deeply sad and troubling that's going on in this quarter.
And when you look at what's going on, how much to you is about personal responsibility and how much of it is about larger social factors?
I think, I don't know how to cut the numbers here, it's 3-1, 4-1 personal responsibility. I know that that will upset people. And I don't mean to be taking a political position to say that there's nothing wrong in the society. We have plenty of jobs. The government has done everything right and everything that it should. I don't believe that's true. I think there's a place for social and political criticism. But I can't help but look at what happens with other groups in the society, even Black groups like the Haitian immigrants who've come to the country in relatively large numbers in recent years, and contrast that with the indigenous Black American community and see the very different responses that people are making. All of that says to me that there is a substantial scope for personal responsibility here. Whether or not you are a father to your children is a question of personal responsibility. Whether or not you brutalize and terrorize your neighbors is a question of personal responsibility.
The New Yorker magazine published a profile of you earlier this year that described a troubled period in your life. And yeah. I bring this up not to pass judgment, but in the hopes that you might want to use your personal experience to reflect on the larger issue. The article described a period in the 80s when you were using drugs, including crack. You fathered a son out of wedlock. And I was wondering if you emerged from that thinking that what you had was a unique personal problem or whether you saw it as a reflection of a larger social problem.
Well, I must say I looked at it as a personal problem. It was certainly not a unique one. And it is something that the fact that I have gone through it and come out the other side makes me especially sensitive to this call for atonement and responsibility and to the spiritual dimension of people facing up to what they have not done and determining and seeking the power to go in a different direction, because I know that it can be done. I believe it's necessary, and I know that it can be done. Drugs are out there in our society, and we're all influenced by the culture in which we live. We're confronted with various temptations and so on. Here I was, a person of tremendous opportunity, all the blessings in the world, and nevertheless found myself caught up in something that was essentially nihilistic. So much easier, therefore, for me to understand that someone with few opportunities and little recourse might find themselves in a similar situation. So I have a great deal of sympathy, but I also have an understanding that the way one gets out of that situation is through determining to turn one's life around and then having the discipline and the power to confront these problems and deal with them.
Did you come out the other end with a different set of political principles or social beliefs?
I came out a good deal more humble. And I think ultimately, as I am now developing different political and social beliefs, the reason for that is that I'm no longer one of these people who thinks I know it all, thinks the issue is easy, or, you know, can with a kind of hubristic contempt dismiss people who are struggling in tough situations with the back of my hand. You know, I just have a little bit more of a step back and let's take a look at this situation and a good deal more sympathy for people. And I think that's affecting my politics, to be sure.
Well, Glenn Lowry, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you for having me, Terry.
Glenn Lowry is the author of a collection of essays on race and responsibility called One by One, From the Inside Out. More on the Million Men March after a break. This is Fresh Air. We wanted to know if the Million Man March is having an impact on the young people Jeffrey Canada works with. He's the president of the Reedland Centers for Children and Families in Harlem, a program of schools and community centers providing safe havens for children. He's the author of a book he describes as a personal history of violence in America called Fist, Stick, Knife, Gun. Canada says there's been a new enthusiasm generated about the march in the past couple of weeks. The march offers an opportunity for young men to channel their rage in a socially acceptable way, rage that, he says, might otherwise explode on the street. Most of the young men he knows who are going will be going with older men. I asked Jeffrey Canada how he would describe the problems facing African-American men today.
When you begin to look at statistically what's happening to African-American men, it's really quite alarming. We have here in Harlem, where I work at Reedland, there was a study recently that found that men had the same survival chance as men did in Bangladesh, that it really had approached really the third world conditions in terms of life expectancy. Many of them are presently in jail. There are many who are presently infected with AIDS virus, and I think when you look at the community, you see a community that really feels that its very survival is in peril right now, and that's certainly the case in the poorer ends of the African American community, where many men are unemployed. The unemployment rate in the community that I work in is over 35% for African American men, and that doesn't include the discouraged workers, men who've given up looking for jobs. So it's pretty bleak right now, and I would say that things have felt to be declining in terms of the, I think, pressures that the men have had to face over the last 10 to 12 years, that it's gotten much more difficult in terms of African-American men and making it in society.
Now, a word that's being used a lot in conjunction with the march is atoning. This is supposed to be a day for African-American men to atone, then to reaffirm their commitment to families and communities. How's the idea of atoning playing among the young people that you know?
Well, you know, I think I've heard a really mixed a reaction to the issue of atonement. There are African-American men whom I know saying that, you know, there's a huge problem with men supporting their children and making sure that these children have two-parent families and fathers who care for them and take care of them. We certainly know there's an awful lot of black-on-black violence, and it's a real issue that we are the ones who are really killing one another at record numbers. But there's also a recognition that in this country right now, there seems to be a turning away from people of color in terms of some of the economic supports. And, you know, I point out things like the earned income tax credit that's being eliminated. They're planning to take, it's not being eliminated, about $30 billion out of this earned income tax. This is a tax credit for working Americans who happen to be poor. It's like, you know, here's something. You played by the rules. You didn't go on welfare, and we know you're not making it, so here's a couple extra dollars. People feel very cynical when they hear that those kinds of programs are being wiped out. Youth programs are being wiped out. Health and welfare programs are being wiped out, even at the same time that corporations are making more and more profit in this country. And I think that some of the young people are saying, well, we want to go and we want to atone for what we've done, but we also don't want to let America forget that it has a responsibility and it's not been playing fair in terms of an allocation of the resources. So there is, I think, a healthy debate around what we should accept as African-American men as our responsibility and what we should also really call on society to do in terms of how they spend tax dollars and who they decide to support with those tax dollars.
Well, there really is a big national debate going on now about how much of the problem is a question of personal responsibility and how much of it is caused by larger social problems that the government needs to address. Do you have any thoughts on that?
Well, I think that there is a real, probably mistaken view that government has caused some of these problems, and the way to solve some of these problems is to withdraw government support. You know, when you look, you know, there's been a new study that came out from the Justice Department that found that, you know, there's going to be this huge increase in crime by 2010, looking at how crime and violence, especially violent crime among juveniles, has increased over the last 10 years. It's up over 100%. And at the same time that we have this huge number of new children who are going to become teenagers in about 10 or 15 years, we have a complete backing away from the kinds of youth programs that make a difference in children's lives. And at a funny time, people thought this crime was being committed late evenings and that the older kids were doing these things. And they find that most of the violent crime happens between 3 to 6 when parents are working and their kids need some place to be, to be safe and to keep involved. So on the one hand, we have a government that's suggesting that they are withdrawing money. At the other hand, we know statistically we have an awful lot of young people who are just entering school right now who, if they don't get the kinds of after-school services that we know keeps young people on the straight and narrow, that they're going to end up going into the criminal justice system. I think that there's been a huge investment in this country in jails and prisons. There's even a larger investment with the Crime Act, which puts another $32 billion into jails and prisons, at the same time that the schools are falling apart here in New York, and social programs that really support poor women and children are being cut all over the country.
Do you think that the march might be racially divisive because it is African-Americans only?
I think this country has a huge, huge problem with race right now. I mean, I think it's just evident in all of the polls after the O.J. Simpson verdict. I think that this Million Man March is going to also bring up a lot of the animosities that still exist between the races. I really think that we have a problem that we're not dealing with in America. Blacks and whites, I think, are pulling further apart. I think that we really need to take a much, much more concerted effort to look at what's happening in this country around race. I think that there is a group of Americans who really think that, you know, that race relations is a low-maintenance effort, that you just don't have to do much and things have gotten better and so everything is fine and we should just leave things as it is. And I just remind people that if we look at what's happened in other countries that have sort of taken that view, if you look at what happened in Yugoslavia, I was there in 69, and it was, you know, the country seemed fine. I never thought that that country could have such hatred among the different groups of people who lived there. If you don't put the kind of energy it takes to maintain the kind of racial harmony that we have in this country, if you don't invest that energy, indeed, it seems to me that the half-life on the goodwill between the races decays at such a rapid rate that we end up reverting to the prejudices and the biases that many of us thought that we had left behind in the 50s and the 60s. And I think that this march has the potential to alienate more blacks from whites than to join people together. African Americans need to come together and accept the fact that they have to be part of the solution for their own problems. At the same time, we don't want to give an impression that this is something that ought to alienate white Americans, I think, from the struggles and the issues that black Americans face. So I worry about the issue of the perceived sexism within the march, and I worry about the issues of the perceived racism within the march, as it being a black-only march, and think that this country really needs to focus an awful lot of attention on the factor of race relations and how they are not as good as people would like to pretend that they are in this country.
Are a lot of young people asking you for your advice about whether you think they should go to the march or not?
Most young people have I think, reached their own conclusion that they want to go. And it's really interesting, Terry. This is something that, this is not people who are followers of Minister Farrakhan or even know an awful lot about the Nation of Islam. They have heard that there is something happening, that black men are going to do something positive, and they want to be part of it. And they're going to be part of what they consider to be a statement to America, you know, that they really matter and that their lives are important. You know what worries me so much in this country? You look at that statistic, 1 in 3 African-American between 20 and 29 will enter the criminal justice system. And I know that those other two that aren't going to enter the system are treated as if they're the one-third that will enter. And it brings such a bad feeling to these young men to be treated that way when they know they're going to work, they're doing the right things, they're trying as hard as they can, and they still get accused and blamed by people's eyes and by people's behaviors and by their responses when they walk into stores and other places. So this is an opportunity to say, listen, we want to work, we want to do the right things, we want everything else Americans want, and we're willing to work for it, give us a chance. That's why they're going to Washington to march.
Are you going to go?
I am not going to go. I have both my own personal as well as political reasons that I'm not going. But clearly, I have not been one of the people who have been detracting from the march. I think it's important.
Well, Jeffrey Canada, thank you very much for talking with us.
Well, Terry, it's always a pleasure, and thank you for having me on the show.
Jeffrey Canada directs the Reedland Centers for Children and Families in Harlem. He's the author of Fist, Stick, Knife, Gun, A Personal History of Violence in America. Our program was produced by Naomi Person, Amy Salad, and Phyllis Myers, with Nancy Updike, Kathy Wolf, and Dorothy Farabee. I'm Terry Gross.
Fresh Air is now available on cassette. To order, call 1-800-934-6000. That's 1-800-934-6000. The cost is $9.95 plus shipping and handling. Not all programs are available.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from Random House, publisher of The Practical Guide to Practically Everything, a one-volume personal library by Peter Bernstein and Christopher Ma. Celebrating 25 years of radio excellence, this is NPR, National Public Radio.